Lenny, it's so great to see you. How are you doing tonight?
It's great to see you too, Carolyn. I'm doing well. It's been a long week, but I have to say I'm happy I'm here with you tonight.
Yeah, and honestly, if anything, I'm feeling recharged, rejuvenated after recording today. It's really such a great episode.
I know, I have to say I am as well, which is surprising because I have not gotten enough sleep this week, but I'm feeling pretty good.
Well, on that note, welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, which is our new mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Dr. Kenny Morford. And on tonight's episode, we are going to be discussing the assessment of substance use disorders with Dr. Jeanette Tetreault. But before we get started on that, will you please tell the audience just a little bit more about what we try to do on this show?
Sure, Carolyn. So we are the internal medicine podcast for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge on substance use disorders. And a reminder that most episodes are available for free CME credit through VCU Health CE for all health professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
Tonight's a very special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they are committed to supporting and training the next generation of academic addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about their organization at their website, acam.org.
So tonight we have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Jeanette Tetreault. She is a professor of medicine and public health, vice chief for education for the section of general internal medicine, associate director for training and education in the program in addiction medicine, and fellowship director for addiction medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. She is the current president of the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, or ACAM. Her scholarly work focuses on the integration of addiction care with primary care and also on improving the care of patients with substance use and its associated comorbidities. And she has a specific focus around treating co-occurring HIV and hepatitis C. She is very passionate about reducing stigma associated with substance use through health professions education, and that's for all trainees at various levels. And outside of that, she lives in New Haven with her family. She spends most of her time trying to convince her two daughters that she is remotely cool. And the remainder of her time is spent caring for a plethora of animals that her husband collects. So tonight, Dr. Jeanette Tetreault, she really teaches us how to use an open-ended and non-judgmental approach to connecting with patients to learn about their substance use. She also talks about the importance of language, you know, how to both avoid stigmatizing terms as well as provide accurate terminology when we talk about substance use. And I have to say, you know, she gives us a really helpful three-step approach to taking a comprehensive substance use history. And the last step of that is a cool mnemonic called RIP-TEAR, but you'll have to listen to the rest of the episode to figure out what it stands for.
We're going to be rip-tearing it up, Kenny.
That's
that
right.
That was awful. That was so bad.
Keep it. All right. So without further ado, let's jump into it.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Hey, Jeanette, thank you so much for coming on the show. We are so excited to have you on tonight. And I know our audience has been looking forward to this episode as well. So can you please start out by giving us just a one-liner to tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. I've been looking forward to this too. My name is Jeanette Tetreault. I am a primary care internal medicine doc who also has special training in addiction medicine. I take care of the full spectrum of patients with addiction and its comorbidities. And I'm a mom of a 10-year-old and 13-year-old girl. So I'm busy.
So Jeanette, I hear that you're a mom of some pets as well. Can you tell us about some of your pets?
Sure. I wouldn't say this is necessarily by choice. My husband is a veterinarian, so I come home to various animals at any given time. We have dogs, cats, chickens, all kinds of different types of fish. And my husband and daughters are beekeepers, so I have thousands and thousands of pet bees as well.
Amazing. Well, before we jump into our case, we were hoping if you could tell us about some of your favorite aspects of working in addiction medicine.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the most rewarding career there is, to be honest. I love taking care of patients who are in a place of some vulnerability, but certainly ready to, you know, make some changes in their life and to help just be present with patients as they go through that process is extremely rewarding. The other aspect of my job and life that I really love is training the next generation of addiction providers and learning from them. And so those taking care of patients and working with trainees, I think, are the two most rewarding aspects of my job.
Well, I'll say, somebody who has trained under you, it has really opened my eyes to how rewarding addiction medicine can be. And that's why I love this field so much. And I feel really privileged to get to do the work I do a lot because you taught me how to do all this. So with that said,
you were easy to teach. You were easy to teach.
Carolyn was easy to teach.
Okay, fair enough.
But with all that said, why don't we jump into our case? So this is our case from Cash Like Memorial. We have Mr. S. He is a 32-year-old man who's presenting to your primary care office because he's been having burning in his chest. And on further assessment, he discloses that he's been drinking nearly every day. And he also says that he intermittently uses cocaine to help him focus at work. So when you start to probe gently about his alcohol use, he says, "I'm not a junkie or an addict like my uncle is." So, you know, there are a lot of myths out there that, you know, addiction is caused by a lack of willpower or it's a moral failing. Can you explain to us, you know, how we understand addiction today through the biopsychosocial model?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Addiction, as defined by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, is a treatable, chronic medical condition involving complex interactions in brain circuits, genetics, the environment, and an individual's own life experiences. They also go on to say people who have addiction engage in substance use or behaviors that become compulsive and also contribute to harmful consequences, right? So I think sort of thinking about that in the rubric of other chronic conditions that we treat in primary care and general psychiatry at any given time is really important. I mean, I think those analogies can be really helpful. They also go on to say, you know, prevention efforts and treatment approaches for addiction are generally as successful as those for other chronic diseases. So again, making the connection with other things that we treat every day. I think that can be really helpful, not only when, as healthcare professionals, we're thinking about how to approach substance use and substance use disorder, but also when we talk to patients and their families. I think some really key notable aspects of the definition of addiction are that it's both preventable and treatable, right? So again, this is the idea that this is a condition that has a complex interaction and it's not just a patient choice and that there are approaches we can take to care for patients. I think the other things that we need to consider when we're thinking about addiction and the sort of environmental interplay with the way addiction plays out is, you know, there are social, legal, and political structures that really contribute to the way one experiences addiction. And we need to take those into account.
That's great. I really like the piece in terms of just normalizing it like any other chronic disease. Do you have a spiel that you give your patients when you're discussing addiction with them?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, again, likening it to something they can understand. So as a primary care provider who also does addiction work, if I know that they have a sister or a brother with diabetes, that's an easy analogy to make. Or if they themselves have experienced complications of mood disorder in the past, then making those analogies can be really helpful. So I think my spiel does tend to be individualized based on the patient's frame of reference. But I think, you know, as much as we can make sure that patients have their say in the way they experience substance use and substance use disorder, and coming from a frame not just of a paternalistic kind of old school medical model, but understanding what they like about their substance use, what it provides for them, but also exploring how it may be affecting their day-to-day life. I think bringing that balance in is vitally important.
And unfortunately, there is so much stigma surrounding this topic of addiction. It's just everywhere. And I'm curious, I mean, part of actually, I should say, what we want to do on this podcast is to help break down some of that stigma. So are there common terms you tend to use when you're discussing substance use disorders? And are there some terms you really try to avoid using with your patients?
Yeah, thank you again for that question. I think that's really where we can make a huge impact, not only with our patients, but their loved ones, and with other healthcare professionals with which we interact. So I think there's stigmatizing terms, and there's grossly inaccurate terms that not only may prevent people from wanting to come to us for care, but also kind of perpetuate myths about the way substance use is experienced and treated. And so I think we have a lot of opportunities as clinicians and healthcare professionals to break down these barriers and break down this stigma. I think it's important to note we're not the only ones who have these opportunities. So, you know, within the lay press, in pop culture, there are a lot of opportunities to break down this stigma. And, you know, in fact, the Associated Press style book has very specific terms that they hold their journalists accountable for to use or not use with regard to substance use. And I think that that's something that we as healthcare professionals should hold ourselves to those same standards. And so I think some really important terms kind of came out in our case, right? Mr. J specifically said, "I'm not a junkie. I'm not an addict like my uncle," right? And I think those terms, while patients may use them, as healthcare professionals, we should really reflect accurate terminology, right? So if a patient is concerned about what kind of cloud may be over them if they're labeled as an addict or a junkie, you should use medically accurate terms like substance use or substance use disorder. And I'll just say, as a provider who sometimes works in hospitals where we do consultations or in outpatient settings where other providers refer patients to us, we see these terms in the medical record where patients are actually referred to things like addict, junkie, substance abuser. And I just really want to challenge our audience to think, would we ever call someone with diabetes a sugar abuser, right? Or a carbohydrate abuser? We would never do that. So really thinking through how we can accurately represent patients through language, and I think that's important. So, you know, how we refer to the patient, I think, is one way we need to be really accurate. How we refer to the monitoring of patients. So it's not uncommon in addiction treatment to think about using terms like clean or dirty with regard to the way patients present with their urine toxicology tests, for instance. And these can be really stigmatizing terms. What other condition do we refer to as dirty? So using, again, medically accurate terms, if a urine toxicology is positive or negative for certain substances, it's a much more accurate reflection of what's going on than clean or dirty. So those are just a couple. I think one other term that I really would like to highlight is terms used to refer to treatment. You know, addiction is not the only stigmatized condition that humans experience, right? So certainly mental health conditions, HIV, hepatitis C, they come with a lot of stigma. But addiction is a little bit unique in that the treatment itself is often stigmatized. So it's not uncommon when patients present to me and I offer them treatment options that they discount something like methadone as a treatment for opioid use disorder because they're worried about how that may reflect on them in society, on their loved one, right? So would we ever, Could you ever imagine experiencing a patient coming in and saying, oh, no, not lisinopril. What would the people at my tennis club think? It would never happen. So I think, you know, utilizing accurate terminology with regard to treatment, and one of the terms that I think can be really problematic is medication-assisted treatment, or MAT. Medication doesn't assist treatment. Medication is treatment. And this is something that, as healthcare professionals, we can really model.
And I think the term that my go-to term is medications for opioid use disorder, medications for alcohol use disorder, because I totally agree. I think it's time to sort of start shifting away from MAT, which is a common term that I still see being used. And man, I cannot wait till the day that there's like a little spell checker that's invented that can just go through and fix and destigmatize my patient's notes and in the chart.
If only Epic had that.
Epic, if you're listening, this is what we want.
You know, I also really appreciate that you are kind of emphasizing how accurate language is what we're looking for, because I find that oftentimes stigmatizing language isn't accurate, as you mentioned. And, you know, if I, like when I'm working on consults and if I get a consult that says, you know, 32-year-old man with substance abuse, like, I don't know what that means. But if I get a consult that says a 32-year-old man with a history of cocaine use and opioid use who was previously treated with methadone, now I can really like wrap my head around what's happening there. And I think that's what happens with these inaccurate and often stigmatizing terms, is that they are labeling someone with that bias right there. And they're not giving us the medical kind of knowledge we need. They're not giving us the facts that we need to help kind of develop a treatment plan or kind of assess what's going on there. And, you know, before we, oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thank you for that. And I want to highlight one of the things that you said. Substance abuse was an accepted term because it was in the DSM-IV. I'm a lot older than you guys, but that was, you know, what I learned from. But if you look at the current edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, abuse is not a term, a diagnostic term. And so I think we need to be really mindful of that when we're talking to colleagues who may have trained in different eras. So, and I think it's an opportunity to really, you know, explain that abuse in and of itself, again, carries some stigma with it.
Is there any evidence to suggest that the terms that we use impact patient care?
Yeah, there is evidence, good evidence, actually. You know, there were two really important studies that were published over a decade ago that looked at the language that we use. And so one of the studies randomized mental health professionals to read vignettes describing patients and then answer a questionnaire about how they would approach those patients. And the vignettes were literally identical, except that in one vignette, the patient was referred to as someone with substance abuse. And in the other vignette, the patient was referred to someone as with a substance use disorder. And interestingly, the mental health professionals felt that the person who was described as having or being a substance abuser was culpable and, you know, required legal implications to manage their condition. Whereas the patient with a substance use disorder, the folks that read that vignette really suggested that the patient would benefit from treatment. And so, again, this can really change the approach to which with which we manage patients. A more recent study that was published in JAMA really looked at kind of anti-stigma campaigns and how they affect how healthcare workers, think about patients. And this was specifically related to opioid use disorder. And having campaigns that had both, you know, kind of a visual component and a narrative component really suggested that treatment of opioid use disorder and targeting healthcare professionals with anti-stigma language was more likely to lead to more effective treatment recommendations for patients. And I think listen, we're facing skyrocketing opioid overdose deaths and tainted drug supply. We really need an all hands on deck approach to get our patients into effective treatment and maintained an effective treatment. And if something as low risk as the words we use can change that dynamic, I mean, why aren't we all doing it?
Such an important point. And, you know, it's good to know that there is evidence backing these changes to language to make them less stigmatizing and more accurate. And, you know, one last thing while we're talking about language is, you know, I think something that I learned training under you was how important it is to use person first language. So I was wondering if you could just kind of briefly define what it means to use person first language for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, it's that easy, right? It's, you know, defining the person first rather than their disease. I don't want to be labeled as a diabetic or a cirrhotic, right? I'm a human. I'm a person. I'm a mom, as we described, a mom of kids and a bunch of animals, right? And so, you know, that is who I am first. And my healthcare conditions don't define me. So I think that we owe that to our patients as well. So, you know, this is a, you know, young man, young woman, young person with substance use, as you mentioned, Kenny, defining what substance it is and how they engage with substance use rather than calling them, you know, a substance user, right? We are not defined again by what we put into our bodies. We're defined by who we are and how we interact with the world.
So thinking to our case, so, you know, Mr. S, who told us that he's been drinking some alcohol, you know, most days of the week and also using some cocaine, you have that knowledge now. What's your framework for kind of how you would discuss this patient's substance use and how you would kind of gather more information as part of a substance use assessment?
Yeah, so we try to boil it down into three basic steps. This is for my own kind of approach. You know, again, I'm a primary care provider. I need to do a lot of things in a short visit. So, you know, thinking through what kind of stepwise approach can I take? So before I even knew what Mr. J sort of did from a substance use standpoint, I'd institute screening. Evidence-based screeners that can fit into my workflow. There are single item screeners. There are screeners that are integrated into health records that make it very easy. So that's step number one. Step number two is if you have a patient who screens positive, really going that next step, right? How do we assess that patient? Getting a sense of what they're using, how often, how much, and do they meet criteria for a DSM-5 diagnosis of a substance use disorder? And there are 11 criteria that, you know, I don't necessarily think you need to have those all memorized, but you need to understand what they are, you know, how they affect the patient and their life. And we can sort of think about that in three main buckets. So physiologic manifestations, things like craving for a substance, tolerance, you know, needing more of a substance to get a desired effect, or withdrawal. So if a patient stops using a substance, has no access to a substance because of many different environmental factors, or decides they want to cut back, if they experience physiologic consequences because of that. So that's kind of one bucket that we can think about. Another bucket is, you know, do they use a substance despite some consequences, despite ongoing health consequences or life consequences? And then I think the other kind of hallmark feature of a substance use disorder is this loss of control. Many of my patients use substances in a very controlled way. But when they lose control, that's certainly something that we need to kind of understand as a, you know, again, as a healthcare provider and help patients through that loss of control. So that's sort of the assessment step. So first step screening, second step assessment, which gets a sense of how much they use, how often, and do they meet criteria for substance use disorder. And then the last step is really sort of gathering some more information to evaluate where a patient is and what kind of treatment plan you might want to institute.
When you're discussing a patient's substance use with them, when I first started out, I felt so awkward thinking about all 11 criteria. At first, I was so tempted just to read off the sheet and ask people like yes or no. I'm curious. I have changed since then, mostly through your teaching and additional training. But what do you sort of say to a patient to help them open up and discuss this, what can be a pretty sensitive topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think, tell me about your substance use, right? Being very open-ended, inquisitive, and really there with the patient and non-judgmental. I think that goes a really, really long way. That's my feeling. I'd be interested to hear from you, Carolyn and Kenny, what your approaches are. But I feel like if you just ask that question, a lot of times you get so much to fill in, you know, whether they meet criteria for a substance use disorder or not.
I definitely like to let the patient tell me their story. So sometimes I'll keep it as simple as that. Can you tell me a little bit more about your story of how you use substances? And we'll kind of probe accordingly to get more details out as needed. And I think, like you said, it's super important to make people feel like they're not judged. Again, using the person first language, normalizing it, feeling comfortable talking about it. I think sometimes folks can sense if we are uncomfortable talking about it as providers. I think I want to make sure to that patient, so I'm not, this is not a punitive space. I'm going to support you and take care of you no matter what. I like to say something up top about that, that in our clinic, we care for all patients no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I trained with both of you, so I use a similar approach. And I think, you know, one of the things that I do think it is important is the setting that I'm in, you know, so I mean, if we're in the clinic, and this is someone who's seeking treatment, they're usually more forthcoming about telling me about why they're here to see me, about their cocaine use, for example. But, you know, if I'm in the hospital, and it's somebody who's admitted for some other thing, and it just comes up that they're using a certain substance or multiple substances, and might not be ready to talk with me about it, I think, you know, being okay with giving it some time. Like sometimes when I'm working with trainees, they're like, I have to get every piece of this history right now. And I'm like, you know, we got to meet people where they are. And if someone's uncomfortable, in pain, they're tired, we can kind of open up the conversation about it. But if the person isn't ready to talk at that moment, then, you know, ask for permission if I can come back and talk more about it later. I mean, that typically is an approach that I'll use.
And withdrawal as well. If somebody is in withdrawal,
it's
not the best time to ask all these questions. Help them feel better first.
100%.
Yeah, and I think that there's so many approaches you can take to do that, right? Some of it is normalizing. Some of it is asking permission. Kenny, as you mentioned, some of it's just if you don't know what a patient's talking about, or you know, just being truly curious and, you know, giving them the space to teach you a little bit. And I think that really comes down to this phrase of meeting patients where they're at, recognizing that it's a bi-directional discussion where you are not coming in just to gather information from them, but you're coming in to get enough information so that within the privilege that you have as their provider, you can help them feel a little bit better, so that they can make informed decisions about their care.
So it's really helpful to hear about this three-step approach that you just laid out for us, where, you know, that first step is screening with a validated instrument. And then the second step is assessment, you said, with, you know, kind of getting a sense of the quantity and frequency of a particular substance that's being used. And then the third is evaluation. But, you know, to kind of get back to that number two assessment piece, so based, what does that tell us actually? You know, like if someone's saying they're drinking, you know, every day of the week, or how many drinks they're having, like what do we take from that information? Because they've already screened positive, right? So, I mean, why not just jump straight to the DSM-5 criteria?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think with alcohol specifically, there's a clear spectrum that's been kind of delineated in the literature where the density, the quantity and the frequency with which someone uses alcohol sort of changes the dynamic of their risk level. So there is this kind of middle ground that maybe doesn't meet criteria for an alcohol use disorder specifically using those DSM criteria, but that we as providers could really do a pretty low cost, low risk intervention and help them decrease their likelihood of going on to develop an alcohol use disorder, and also decrease their likelihood of developing complications. And this really is defined numerically. And so for the definition of at-risk drinking, there is some sort of gender specificity to it, and that's related to, you know, a couple of different biologic mechanisms with regard to how alcohol is broken down in the body. But for women and those over 65 years of age, we consider at-risk alcohol intake as consuming more than 3 standard drinks per sitting or more than 7 drinks a week. And for men, it's greater than 4 drinks per sitting or greater than 14 drinks per week. So those quantity frequency questions can be really helpful at delineating that at-risk category, which may not meet criteria for an alcohol use disorder.
And one thing I've heard, you know, I mean, you brought up this kind of gender difference in these drink cutoffs. But I think there was a study a couple years ago that's, you know, a fairly recent study that looked at how these single question screeners perform for people who identify as gender non-binary. And it sounds like the kind of higher alcohol limit seems to perform better in those populations.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's certainly the cutoff that I would kind of consider when caring for patients clinically or certainly teaching our trainees.
So maybe we could move on to this like third step now. So evaluation. So let's say in this case, you know, you've screened positive, you've got the quantity and frequency, you've diagnosed, let's say we've now diagnosed our patient with a severe alcohol use disorder, maybe a mild cocaine use disorder. What happens in the evaluation step?
Yes, we have a fun little mnemonic that can make it sort of easy to consider how to think about this step, and we call it RIP-TEAR. And this is based on sort of older literature looking at how you gather information to make an informed treatment plan. I mean, a lot of times our treatment planning may be multiple healthcare professionals adding into how we put all this information together. But nonetheless, as, you know, the institutor of a treatment plan, you know, you want to make sure that you've got all the information you need. And that's where RIP-TEAR can really be helpful. So what is RIP-TEAR? So getting a sense of imminent risk to the patient with regard to their substance use. And that's really vital. Again, we've kind of already talked a little bit about the drug supply. We've talked about, you know, seeing patients in really vulnerable states when they come into the hospital with complications of alcohol, cocaine, opioids. So really getting a sense of what are those imminent risks that needs to be the tippy top of our treatment plan, right? That needs to be something that we address right away. So that's risk. I is initiation. So when did the individual start using substances? Not only the primary substance that you're addressing right now, but substances in general. This information sort of helps frame the perspective and gives us a sense of, again, the density and the length of time that that substances have been part of this individual's life. It may change the way we approach treatment and talking to the patient. P stands for pattern. And, you know, a lot of times we don't necessarily need to come up with another line of questioning to get this information. We may have gotten this information at other pieces. So a lot of times that P you've gotten from those quantity frequency questions in step 2. It's really just, okay, do I have everything I need to know so that I can understand, is this person going to start having alcohol withdrawal right now? I need to know when their last drink was. I need to understand the pattern overall and the pattern with which they're presenting at this moment. So that's RIP, RIP, and then TEAR. So T is what treatment episodes has the patient engaged in before? And I think it's really important to recognize that treatments take different forms over different times. And so just because a patient may tell you, gee, I used disulfiram for alcohol use in the past and it didn't work for me, getting a sense of what didn't work, what was the issue? Well, it gave me a headache, but it may be at a time when they were having headaches for other reasons. So just teasing that out a little bit can help us understand how we may frame different treatment options for a patient for this given presentation. And I, you know, just as a bit of an aside, and I'm sorry to get beyond myself, I think another stigmatizing term is saying that, and this goes for all patients, but not just patients with substance use, but that a patient failed treatment, right? So failing treatment, patient doesn't fail a treatment. A lot of times the treatment fails the patient. And so I think that's just something we need to keep in mind when we're exploring treatment episodes with patients and recognizing that just because a patient has, you know, experienced a certain outcome from treatment in one setting, it doesn't take it off the table for future. All right. So RIPT, we talked about treatment, is effects. And it's easy for us to explore those kind of unpleasant or negative effects. And really a lot of our assessment in step two with DSM really explores a lot of those negative effects. But I think it's disingenuous not to ask what the positive effects are for the patient. And we may have gotten this in our open-ended questioning initially with the patient, but, you know, coming back, clarifying, summarizing, making sure you got it right. Because again, understanding both the negative and positive experience patients have with substances are going to markedly change the way they experience treatment. And if you don't understand that and you're trying to employ a treatment paradigm for a patient, you may really have some problems. So that's effects. A is abstinence. Have there been periods of abstinence before? Under what circumstances? It's not uncommon that I've had patients tell me they found it very easy to abstain from substances during times of pregnancy. So some of my, you know, patients who've been pregnant say, I didn't use during my pregnancy, or I didn't use, you know, when I was doing really well at my job and getting positive feedback. So those are things that as providers and institutors of treatment plans, we can help a patient through treatment by understanding, you know, when were periods of stability. And I also just want to hit home the point that abstinence is not necessarily the only outcome we're looking for with treatment. It's kind of that holy grail outcome, but it's not necessarily the outcome that we want to make our patients believe that that's the only thing we're looking for. And then the last is R. What are some things that we need to consider as we're putting a treatment plan into place that could risk our patients returning to use or returning to unsafe, unhealthy use? And so getting a sense of, you know, gee, I know I become very unstable during the anniversary of my son's death. Understanding that as a healthcare provider can be very powerful so that we can put prevention efforts into place in the future.
This is such a helpful approach. I think it really does a great job at getting the different aspects of a patient's story, of a patient's life and their context to really help create a treatment plan that best fits them. So just to summarize, rip tear for the audience. So R, we got risks. I, we have initiation. P, pattern. T, treatment. What's their prior treatment? E, effects. What are some of the positive and negative effects of the substance? A, we have abstinence. When was the individual doing well? And R, we have return to use, relapse prevention. What are high risks of time where that patient may find themselves struggling a little bit more in their journey?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think it's, again, it's a framework that can help you organize information more so than be a specific line of questioning.
Yeah, I love RIPTEAR. I have to say, since I learned it, I use it all the time, even when I get, you know, like curbsides from people who I trained with, or when I'm, you know, in the hospital and I get a call, the first thing I do is I write down RIPTEAR on a sheet of paper. And then it just kind of reminds me of, you know, did I gather all this information yet? I can do it quickly and know that there's things I have to come back to. So super helpful. I also think starting with R, the risks, is really important. In the fentanyl era, of course, we're worried about overdose. But also, like we had mentioned earlier about, you know, maybe a patient doesn't want to talk to us because they're currently having withdrawal symptoms. And that's the R, right? Like, this person's in acute alcohol withdrawal. We need to treat this before we can have a conversation with them. So yeah, really, really useful mnemonic.
And back to our case, we decide that Mr. S, he does have a diagnosis of severe alcohol use disorder and meets criteria for a mild cocaine use disorder. He says, yeah, I'm really ready to connect a treatment for my alcohol use disorder, but he doesn't feel like the diagnosis of cocaine use disorder really resonates with him. So I'm curious, how do you approach talking to a patient who may disagree or not feel that the diagnosis of a substance use disorder is reflective of their personal experience?
Yeah. And again, I think we're not here to get in a kind of, you know, battle of the wills with our patients. That's not why I went into medicine. So I think, you know, we provide the facts, we provide what we've found on our assessment. And I think that's where using kind of DSM in a pretty formulaic way. I mean, utilizing the buckets that we talked about, but then filling in the blanks to really, you know, get a good sense of where we're falling with a diagnosis. And I think we've alluded to, but haven't kind of said specifically during this episode, is based on the number of criteria a patient meets, you actually can get a sense of their severity, mild, moderate, or severe. And so I think, you know, presenting to the patient what you've found, and again, not necessarily putting up walls, but coming back to the effects and coming back to the risks, and always framing your discussions with patients in keeping them healthy and safe. I think that's going to go a lot further than trying to convince them that they have a health condition that they may not be ready to accept. And I'll tell you, this doesn't just happen with substance use disorder, right? I mean, this happens with diabetes. This happens with congestive heart failure. This happens with liver disease. So, you know, just coming back to those frameworks that we deal with in the hospital and in the clinic every single day can help us as healthcare providers not get into that back and forth with the patient.
And I think something that's really unique, the times we are living now, is that patients can see their notes. They can see what's in the chart. That's a huge part of their medical record. I know I have had patients come to me in clinic and be very distressed about something another provider placed or something I even wrote, you know, because there's clearly room for misinterpretation, I think, of chart notes. So I think something I've recently done in my practice, particularly if people say, you know, I'm not sure if this fits with me, is I actually just show them like what I'm writing, and like I write things like objectively as I can. I give the opportunity for the patient to correct things that they disagree with. But I want to be very cautious, one, that we're like making accurate diagnoses, and that we're making sure as well that we're like we're writing things that our patients are comfortable with, that are accurate, you know, in their charts.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. And I think that's so important for the audience, right? And I think that's where these terms are so important. I think what's gonna rile a patient up is if they see things in their chart that really put labels or inaccuracies in terms of who they are. I'm going to feel a lot different if I'm reading my chart and it says I have an alcohol or opioid use disorder than if it says I am an abuser or a substance user or, you know, I'm drug seeking, right? So those are things that I think we need to be really, really mindful of in this day and age. And when I trained, that was not a concern. And so it's easy to fall back on those kind of behaviors as healthcare professionals to just kind of write that stuff without recognizing what those implications might be. Because we know, right, there is tons of literature that if our patients don't trust us, we're not gonna be able to make the impact that we're hoping for.
This has been so great. I just wanted to ask, we're sort of almost out of time, but I wanted to go back and ask, there are so many stigmatizing words we use in addiction. Are there any other common terms that you think are really important for our audience to know and rethink about how they're using it in their clinical practice?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked about, with regard to this case, specifically addict. And I think that's a That's an easy one to understand. Even the word alcoholic, it's perpetuated a lot in common diagnoses we use. Alcoholic hepatitis, alcoholic cirrhosis. So it's very easy to fall back on that term. And I think really, again, shifting the way we characterize these conditions can help us model appropriate and accurate terminology. So, you know, alcohol-related hepatitis, alcohol-related cirrhosis. And I realize that's another word, another step, a hyphenated word, but I think we all can agree it really matters.
Thank you so much, Jeanette, for being here with us tonight. We have learned so much, and we're hoping our listeners have as well. Do you have any main take-home points for our listeners today?
Yeah, this was such a pleasure for me. I just want to mention that I'm a huge fan of the Curbsiders, and getting to be a guest is a little bit, I feel like an imposter a little bit. So I appreciate the invitation. You know, I think take-home points, it kind of comes back to a lot of what we think about just with regard to compassionate patient care, right? So being accurate in the way that we approach patients and in our written and oral communication with them and their families and other healthcare professionals. Being very open-ended, we can get a lot of information if we just ask open-ended questions. Utilizing some frameworks to organize the information so that we can then ask more probing questions to fill in the blanks and put together, you know, a treatment plan that centers the patient's wishes, the patient's safety, and the patient's health. I think those are the main take-home points. And utilizing a three-step process to do that, the DSM criteria, which is not just for psychiatrists, it's for all of us, and thinking about the RIP-TEAR mnemonic to, again, organize vital information so that we can prioritize how to approach our treatment plan. Those are my main take-home points.
Is there anything you would like to plug on our show today?
Yeah, I'd like to plug that training is great. And I can attest to like two of the best trainees ever on this that are here on this episode, Dr. Morford and Dr. Chan. But addiction medicine fellowships are a great way to learn this stuff and get a lot of practice with implementing it. The American College of Academic Addiction Medicine is the home for addiction medicine fellowships, program directors, faculty, coordinators, and most importantly, fellows. So check us out.
I second that plug. Doing an addiction medicine fellowship is great. You should absolutely do one if you're considering it.
Completely agree.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get your show notes now at thecurbsiders.com/addiction.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge. And to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or you can contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. A special thanks to Dr. Matt Watto and Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project, as well as to ACAM, the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine. Learn more about the organization at acam.org.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. And until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
And I'm Dr. Kenny Morford. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you some pearls around addiction medicine.